Hello, good morning, good afternoon, and good night to all those who end up joining me in these dark woods for this, the Great Journey Podcast, and I'm your trail guide, Luke Keesh. Here we go down the strange, bizarre, and spooky paths and trails of the unusual happenings and people which fill our world. So, would you kindly grab your thermoses and fill her up, and we'll head out for tonight's snowy trail on the winter solstice and Yule. But before we can head out, we have to pay the undertaker in this trail's undertaker's fee, which is, what's the difference between Tiger Woods and Santa? Santa stopped at three hoes. And because of the winter season, I'll add one more. What does one hoe plus two hoes make? A very jolly Santa. Then, for this trail, it will be a little bit shorter than normal, but will consist of at least six campfires. The first one, we will go over the winter solstice itself. Then, we will move on to some ancient festivals held on the winter solstice. Then, we will go over a campfire specifically on Saturnalia and ancient Yule beliefs and traditions. Then, there will be a campfire over Yule traditions that still persist to this day, and then I'll finish up with a mythological minute going over a family of trolls or giantesses that scare people on Yule. So, let's get into this winter's trail. So, before I get into some festivals during this time of year, let's get into the first campfire about the winter solstice. And this will also show why ancient cultures decided to pick this time to represent certain aspects of their mythology and certain cultures that they had. The winter solstice, in astronomical terms, is the axial tilt of the Earth and gyroscopic effects, as well as the Earth's orbit around the Sun. Polar hemispheres face away from the Sun, producing a winter effect in the northern hemispheres during the months of December through February. And then these same effects are seen when the polar hemisphere faces towards the Sun in the southern hemispheres in the months of June and August. These axial motions create the winter solstice, which mark the shortest day and the longest night of the year. Also, the sun's daily maximum elevation in the sky is at its lowest. Now, in meteorology terms, the winter solstice for the northern hemisphere spans December through February, with cold weather from the gradual lengthening of nights and shortening of the days. The southern hemisphere, this happens in June through August. Now, lastly, the astronomy of the winter solstice, which takes a very precise measurement instead of which the other terms use the winter solstice as more of a seasonal term. The winter solstice marks the movement when the Earth is at a point in its orbit where one hemisphere is most inclined away from the Sun, causing the Sun to appear at its furthest below the celestial equator when viewed from Earth. So, in the northern hemisphere, the winter solstice falls on December 21st or December 22nd when the Sun appears over the Tropic of Capricorn, which is roughly 23.5 degrees south of the equator. Then, in the southern hemisphere, the winter solstice falls on June 21st or June 22nd when the Sun appears over the Tropic of Cancer, roughly 23.5 degrees north of the equator. Now to get into what ancient cultures did to interpret the winter solstice and how they marked it. So, firstly, the winter solstice took on many names depending on the culture that interpreted it. Some names were midwinter, shortest day, extreme of winter, which specifically was a Chinese reference of Dongzi, and was specifically a notation of their Chinese calendar. The famine months, the 40 nights, and there were many more other names. We get the word solstice from Latin use of sun stand, referring to the sun's apparent stop in progress at noontime elevation. Though it is not determined when humans started noticing the winter solstice and marking it as a turning point in the year, it is evident that cultures around the world set up structures to observe the winter solstice and equinoxes. Since Neolithic people relied heavily on farming, so knowing when a seasonal change is coming is good for farming and for the people to stock up on food. And for this season particularly, most of the cattle were slaughtered to eat during the winter and to have less mouths to feed during the cold winter. Most wine and beer was also fermented at this time to be ready to be drank next year. And hence, the amount of partying was taking place was because of the beer and wine from last year's preparation was now ready to be drank. Also, Neolithic people attributed the sun's movement through the sky and its ebbing presence as the sun going through a rebirth or a new beginning, and tried to establish a connection between the life, death, and rebirth deities found in their mythologies. Now to go over some Neolithic sites that they built to monitor and observe the solstice and equinoxes through the year. First, I will talk about Newgrange in Ireland, which predates the pyramids of Giza and was apparently used to monitor the stars and the sun. Particularly on the winter solstice on December 21st on sunrise, but now it's a little bit 4 minutes after sunrise because of the age of the structure and the orbital change that the Earth has gone through since the building of this site. But as the sun rises into the main chamber through a little roof box over the main entrance, it illuminates the Newgrange's passages and chambers for roughly 17 minutes. The light also shines directly onto a stone basin below an intricate carving in spirals of eye patterns and solar disk as well adorn it. The light shining in is also an occurrence at dawn from the 16th to the 23rd of December, but to a lesser extent that seen on the 21st. Then, to move over to the Americas to talk about the Native American culture, specifically one that was located in New Mexico in the U.S., specifically the Chaco Canyons. And this site is called the Sun Daggers, and it's made by the Anasazi tribe. And this tribe was in the area from about 500 to 1300 A.D., and it was rediscovered by Anne Sofari, an artist, in 1977. The specific observation site is 120 meters above the canyon floor near the top of a rock formation called the Fiada Butte. Here stands three slabs of sandstone with open areas to let sunshine through them, and they were leaning against a wall to create shadows on the wall. On that shadow wall was drawn two spiral petroglyphs, one small to the left and slightly above the other main one, which was a larger spiral, and the larger one, if you counted the grooves in the spiral starting from the center outward, it would have 9 on both sides. And with this combination, these stones produce 3 effects. The first is at the summer solstice, when a sliver of sunlight appears near the top of the spiral and seems to slice down through the center of the spiral over the course of 18 minutes. Then, during the winter solstice, is a similar effect, but the sun daggers shine on the edges of the larger spiral on both sides, lasting for about 49 minutes. It also marked both the spring and autumn equinoxes, and this one was a little bit more complex than the other two, with the sun daggers cutting through the center of the small spiral located to the left of the larger one, and in the larger spiral it would cut between the fourth and fifth grooves on the right to the center. And though these are only records because this site isn't operational because of some shifting in the stones in 1989, it is no longer aligned to the spirals to give these effects anymore. But there are many other Anasazi tribe sites similar to this all over southern U.S. and parts of Mexico. And that basically covers the brief overview of what the winter solstice is, the technical terms of it, and some of the sites that you use to monitor it. Brief list, and now we will get into some of the smaller ancient festivals that were practiced on the winter solstice. So the first ancient festival we will talk about is from ancient Egypt, from around 5,000 years ago. They held a festival to celebrate the rebirth of the sun, which was also the birth of Horus, the son of Isis. This festival was set over 12 days to reflect the 12 divisions in their solar calendar, and they would also decorate with greenery, specifically the palm tree leaves, which they would try to find ones with 12 shoots, again to symbolize a complete year, with each shoot representing a month. And not much else is known about this one, but there is a similar festival that is not much known about this one either, but it's simply stated as a Mesopotamian festival, which was similar to the 12-day festival, but it represented the renewal and designed to help the god Marduk to tame the monsters of chaos for another year. And the main ones I will talk about are some Roman festivals. The first one will be the Festival of Brumalia, which is kind of obscure and not much is known about it either. And this was stated to start on November 24th and last for 24 days with sacrifices of goats and pigs made to Olympian gods. It was also thought that each of the 24 days were assigned a letter from the Greek alphabet, starting with Alpha on November 24th and Omega on December 17th. People would use this to indicate who would throw a party for friends and family, and this was determined by the person's first letter in their name. And some people could potentially have 24 consecutive parties if they had people that all had the first letter of the Greek alphabet spanning those 24 days. This is also seen in a 6th century speech by the order Chronosis of Giza, which praised the festivals of Emperor Justinian, who reigned from 527 AD to 565 AD, saying the emperor and his wife Theodora celebrated Brunalia on the adjacent day Iota for Justinian, directly followed by Theta for Theodora. There are also surviving accounts found in cellars of a large estate in Egypt detailing the wine distribution for Brunalia on Apria, the first day of the festival. Most of the records of Brunalia come from a retired 6th century AD public official John the Lydian. He states besides the festivals that this festival was almost banned twice, once in 692 and again in 743, but Brumalia survived until at least the 10th century, being celebrated in the imperial court in Constantinople, and slowly began to merge with other Roman traditions. And before I move on from this particular festival and get into the next one, I want to read a translation of John the Lydian's De Misibus, which translates to On the Months, and it was translated by a Robert Pearson, or Piercy. The Romans customarily divided their citizenry into three groups, and distinguished those who were suitable for arms, those for farming, and those for hunting. And the season of winter brings an end to these pursuits, for in it neither do they arm themselves nor practice farming, because of the season's cold and the shortness of the days. Hence, in the old days, they named it Bruma, meaning short day, and Brumalia means winter festivals. So at that time, until the waxing of the light, ceasing from work, the Romans would greet each other with words of good omen at night, saying in their ancestral tongue, Vienis Annos, meaning live for years. And the farming people would slaughter pigs for the worship of Chronosis and Demeter. And hence, even now, the pig slaughter is observed in December. And the vine dressers would sacrifice goats in honor of Dionysus. For the goat is an enemy of the vines. And they would skin them, fill the skin bags with air, and jump on them. And the civic officials would also offer, at the first fruits of the collected harvest, wine and olive oil, grain and honey, and as many products of the trees as endure and are preserved. They would make loaves without water, and they would bring all these things to the priest of the Great Mother. And this sort of custom still observed even now, and in November and December, until the waxing of the light. They bring these things to the priest for the custom of greeting people by name at the Brumalia. And truth is, they call them Cryonian festivals. And because of this, the church turns away from them and takes place at night because Cronos is in darkness, having been sent to Tartarus by Zeus, and they mysteriously signify the grain from its being sown in the ground and thereafter not being seen. And this is quite true, as has been said. The attention to these things goes on at night, such that finally, in truth, the Brumalia are festivals of the subterranean demons. And that is the end of the passage, and this also finishes up my portion on Brumalia. Next, we will get into Sol Invictus. And this is not a well-known one or a much talked about. It is only really known by name of Sol Invictus, which is the unconquerable sun. And some background on it. Sol is the Roman counterpart to the Greek god of the sun, Helios, who pulls the sun by chariot through the sky. And there are numerous cults of Sol that were practiced in the Roman Republic in the first century, or even before, because it is contributed to famous emperors being involved in the reformation of Sol cults over time. Some specific people that reformed the Sol cults are Nero, Constantine, and Aurelian. Constantine is also the one that decreed on March 7th, 321 AD, Dry Solis, the day of the sun, or Sunday at a later point, was the Roman day of rest, and that was also a connection to the solar cult religions. Then let me briefly touch on the epithet Invictus, which means unconquerable. Invictus comes up with multiple Roman deities, specifically Jupiter, Mars, Heracles, and Apollo, and of course Sol. And the specific Sol Invictus deity is tied to the Mithridatic mystery cults, and later becoming its own festival of Dryas Natalis Solis Invicti. And according to Philocean calendar, during the 4th century was celebrated on December 25th. And the reason I brought this up is multiple historians particularly tie this religion into, and the only reason I bring in Sol Invictus and the solar cults is historians point to this specific holiday being one of the reasons why the Christian mythology ended up picking December 25th to represent the Christ mythology and him being born on the 25th, and also putting Christmas on this day to kind of envelop the solar god, which was already present in Solar Invictus. Now to get into another Roman festival, which has a little bit more information on it, and that is Saturnalia. And this festival also has a lot of traditions which were a proto-form of what Christmas ended up using in the future. But first, I'll give a little bit of background on the actual Saturnalia proceedings, and then I'll talk about the actual ceremony itself. So, first thing is the god behind it, which is the Roman god Saturn. And the original name was the Greek god Cronus, or Kronos, and that is spelled C-R-O-N-O-S, or sometimes with a K instead. This god was worshipped in the pre-Hellenistic period, and was the youngest of the 12 titans birthed by Gaia, the goddess of earth, and Uranus, the goddess of the heavens. Then, on his mother's direction, he castrated his father and separated earth from the sky. After this, he took his sister Rhea as his wife, and together they bore the main group of Olympian gods: Hestia, Demeter, Hera, Hades, Poseidon, and Zeus. But he ended up having the same fear that he would be overthrown like he overthrew his father, so he ended up swallowing all his kids except for Zeus, who Rhea ended up hiding away from him and hiding within Gaia until he grew up to eventually overthrow Cronos. But before Cronos could be overthrown, he was also said to be responsible for the golden race of humans, which was the first race of humans created. Then he was castrated by Zeus, and Zeus either imprisoned him with the rest of the Titans in Tartarus, or he became the king of the Elysian Fields, which is a form of their underworld. And again, this is just a brief look at Cronos through the Greek and Roman tales. And what connects him to this particular festival is the time of the season, and that he was particularly the god of time, but also with that he marked the grain and the grow of the crops, and then the original, and then the eventual harvest of those crops. And then part two of the background is where it took place and when. This was mainly at a temple of Saturn, which was located northwest of the Forum of Rome, and it started as a shrine called Ari Saturni. And then in 497 BCE, dictator Titus Tatius replaced it with the temple of Ara Saturni, and then again it was replaced in the 4th century CE to the temple of Saturn, and 8 of the original columns still stand there today. The reason this temple was important was this is where the official rites for the Saturnalia festival occurred. But before we can go into that, like I said, I want to go into when this festival occurred. The earliest accounts of the Saturnalia festival is from the oldest Roman religious calendar, which was also believed to be made by the founder of Rome, Romulus, and it put it 6 days before the 1st of January, which was December 19th, and this was also considered the day for marking the dedication of the Saturn Temple of Saturn in 497 BCE. Later, when Julius Caesar reformed the calendar and moved Saturnalia to December 17th, and then Caesar Augustus made another change to the festival later on, making it a 3-day festival to encompass December 17th and December 19th. Then, sometime in the late Republic, Saturnalia was expanded to be 7 days to be celebrated, and then in the early Imperial period, it was reduced back down to 3 days, and then a famous emperor, Caligula, changed it in the late Imperial period back to officially be 5 days, but the public observed it for 7 days. The specific reason for the date being picked for December 17th in the first place was the astronomical sign of Capricorn, which was in the house of Saturn, which is also the god, like I mentioned earlier, is the focus for this festival, and for it being with the winter solstice is also between the December 21st and December 23rd on the Julian calendar was close. This was also a good way to mark this period as well. So this festival was created as a dual purpose type of thing. Then the last piece of background is the most accounts from the festival are pieced together from sources of a multi-volume work called the Macrobius and Lucian's Saturnalia, and also Roman Senate records. And with the Senate records, I will get into the first part of Saturnalia, which was the ritual and rites performed at the temple. The first thing done was to remove a wool binding on the statue of Saturn, which was a representation of liberation. Then the rites were performed, and there was two distinct ones. First, the Greek rite, which was Ritus Graecias, and this was sacrificing animals, basically officiated by priests whose heads were uncovered but not named. And then the Roman rite, Captia Volato, and this was performed by priests sacrificing animals with their heads covered with a special toga wrap. And like I said, in both cases, animals were sacrificed. It didn't really specify on a specific type. Then, after this, the Roman Senate would place a deity's image or likeness, like a statue, on the couch at a public banquet to give honor to this deity during these feasting and party times. And as for the public and everybody else on this holiday, all forms of work and school were canceled, exercises were put on hold, and the courts were not in session, so no justice could be handed out or any declarations of war could not be made. This was done so everybody was able to celebrate in any form they chose. and to perform any customs or rituals or rites that they needed to. And the first general custom that was observed by a lot of people was something called role reversal. And this was when the slaves were served by the masters, and they were able to disrespect or talk back to their masters without fear, because this was a temporary time of freedom. And in some depictions or accounts, it was said that the masters were served first, and then the masters would serve the slaves. And this was also held between multiple households, where they would get together and throw huge banquets and perform this kind of custom. And this is all in a way to honor free speech and liberty, and a temporary leveling of social hierarchy. Along with these dinners, it was customary for people to wear a hat called the pelimenis, a conical felt cap, which was usually a mark of a free man. And then a second custom that was observed widely was gambling or dice games, which normally was prohibited or at least frowned upon. And in this way, gambling was something that everybody could do at this time, as a form of games and merriment. Most times it was just coins or nuts that were bet on the games, and it would range from children playing it and to adults doing their own type of thing. And most of the time, this gambling was also held during banquets on the side or outdoors to large-scale parties or festivals. Then a third custom that was widely held for the Romans should sound a little bit familiar. Its original name was Sigalia, and it was basically gift giving. And this was on December 19th, where gifts were given between people. And notably, Emperor Caesar Augustus was particularly fond of what was described as gag gifts, but no examples were really given of this. And children would receive toys or tools at this time. Patrons or bosses would give gifts to the poor or food to the poor. And some of the things that were exchanged ranged wildly in the amount of money spent on it, or the value of these objects really didn't matter as much. And some examples of these objects were wax figurines of like deities, or just general shapes like for dolls for kids, pottery, dice, money boxes, hunting equipment, lamps, perfumes, certain type of foods, festival masks were also given, books, and sometimes it would also include pets, slaves, and exotic animals. And when these gifts were given, they also had a kind of gift card type of thing to go with it, which was a poem or a verse. And typically it was very short, so it would be what we would do with the gift card industry nowadays. And then a fourth custom for Saturnalia was something called the Ruler of Saturnalia, which is basically the master of ceremonies for the festival, similar to the medieval European tradition of the Lord of Misrule at the Feast of Fools. This person had the role and got appointed by lot, and when in this role, when he gave a command, you had to follow it. And some examples were sing naked, throw him in a river, drink, basically have a party, that kind of stuff. Like, he only had like ceremonial type of stuff to do. And they would even be accounts of it being at large scale banquets or smaller banquets too, just a small little ruler of Saturnalia type of role. And those were the main known customs of Saturnalia. And now we'll just kind of like go through a couple of the small points of Saturnalia that encompassed it or just were talked about a little bit. And one of the aspects was something similar to a fruit cake, and that is where they took fruit that was preserved by mixing it with barley mash, pomegranate seeds, pine nuts, raisins, and honeyed wine. And this was also eaten over the course of the holiday and was a very common dish to see in many Roman households. And then also it was very common to decorate public places and individual homes with evergreen trees, evergreen leaves, bushes, mistletoe, holly, and ivy. And the reasons behind evergreen plants in the first place was traced back all the way to 600 BCE, where it was represented for the sun god Mithras, and thus transferred over to other sun gods, since the evergreen plant stayed green year-round, even during the winter solstice time. And bringing evergreen plants into one's home was viewed as honoring that god that it represented. And most of the time, like I said, it represented sun gods in multiple cultures because of its longevity through the winter times. Then mistletoe, it had a very similar reason to the evergreen plant. And first off, if nobody knows, mistletoe is a parasitic plant which grows off of apple trees and other trees, and it doesn't particularly have a root system, and for this reason it was given magical type of properties and was thought to heal and ward off evil. And for the Romans particularly, the white berries were used as symbols of male fertility, and the green represented the female fertility, and it was a balancing of the two with that one plant, so it was used to decorate during this time to promote those two things. And typically it was also hung over doorways, and when it was in this fashion, it was a way to symbolize peace and love to those who entered the home. Then the last plant used in Saturnalia was a pear, and it was holly and ivy, with holly again symbolizing the male being, and hung in households as protection against evil spirits or entities because of its spiky leaves. And this was also hung in above beds to encourage good dreams. And then the ivy plant was also paired with it because it represented the female being. And again, it was a way to balance out the male energy of the plant. And so that was everything that basically goes into Saturnalia that was recorded. And before we move on, I want to go into a mythology portion of it, but there was no mythology pertaining to Saturnalia particularly. So instead, I wanted to tell my version of Persephone's and Hades myth that is the basic reasoning the Greeks had for the seasons, particularly why winter was the way it was. And I kind of put this together from multiple different sources and kind of paraphrased it into my own words for the most part, and it's very, you know, known already what the story is, but I just figured I'd put it in here as a good kind of storytelling for Christmas. And before we get into it, since Saturnalia is the Roman, these are the Roman names for the gods that will be in my story, because I will use the Greek as a basis for it instead of the Roman. Hades was Pluto to the Romans. Persephone was Persephone. Zeus was Jupiter. Helios was Sol. Hermes was Mercury. And Demeter was Ceres. And Hecate was the same in both. And again, I just prefer the Greek over the Roman because the Roman names, I don't know, just don't sound right. And so let me get into the story of Persephone and Hades. So one day, Hades, the god of the underworld, saw Persephone, the goddess of vegetation and grain, with her mother Demeter, the goddess of nature, while on a walk in a garden on Earth. Hades saw Persephone from the underworld and instantly fell in love with her. So Hades decided to go to his brother Zeus, the king of the Olympian gods, for help in this matter. Zeus knew how much Demeter loved her daughter and would reject Hades. So, like most Greek heroes and in Zeus's many dalliances before, they decided to abduct Persephone and trick the goddess Demeter. So later, when Demeter and Persephone went to Earth, Demeter went over to see her bountiful harvest and expect it and supervise it. And Persephone went to play with some of the sea nymphs, or called the Nereids and Naiads, that lived in freshwater lakes, springs, and rivers, and were the spirits of these waters. But before they arrived, Zeus told Gaia, the goddess of Earth, to plant a narcissus flower near where Persephone was about to be, but also out of range so the nymphs would not be able to follow when Persephone went to the flower. So, while playing, Persephone smelled the flower and followed its scent, dancing all the way, ignoring the nymphs' pleas to stay, and once she got to the flower, she plucked it from the ground. As she did, a huge chasm grew from the hole, bigger and bigger, and then out rode Hades in a chariot and grabbed the goddess and brought her back down to the underworld. After Persephone was taken, one of the naiads, Cyane, was so grief-stricken that she melted into the river Cyane at that spot. Demeter heard the cries of the sea nymphs and rushed to where the kidnapping happened. But when she arrived at the location, nobody could tell her what happened to Persephone. And in anger, she cursed the nymphs into a hideous form, bearing the resemblance of a woman with feathers and scaly feet, later to be called the Sirens. So Demeter, in her grief, went to search for her daughter. She disguised herself as an old woman and went out and searched for 9 days and nights. During this time, no plant life on the earth would grow, and all started to die. But on the 10th day, Hecate, the goddess of magic and witchcraft, intervened and asked Helios, the god of the sun, for help. He told Demeter of what happened to her and of the treachery of Hades. So Demeter went to her brother Hades and begged him for Persephone back. But when he refused, she decided to go to Zeus for help. And Zeus couldn't tell her directly that he was involved with the kidnapping of Persephone. But instead, he sent his messenger, Hermes, who is the messenger of the gods. He went down to tell Hades to let Persephone go. But when Hades got there, he found something quite different from what he expected. Persephone was happy. Hades had built her gardens, treated her nicely, and gave her anything she asked for. And when Hermes asked Persephone to go, Hades became fearful that she might leave, so he gifted her 6 pomegranates, which she ended up eating. And this is important because in Greek custom, this meant that she had to return to Hades because it was believed that if one ate food given to them by their captor, that they were tied together, and the person who ate would have to return to the person that the food had been given from. And so Hermes returned to Zeus with this news. And to make both Hades and Demeter happy, Zeus decided that since Persephone ate the 6 pomegranate seeds, Persephone would spend half the year with Hades in the underworld, and then half the year with Demeter. And like I said, this is also what makes the winter seasons, is when Persephone is down in the underworld with Hades, and then the bountiful time of year when crops grow and everything else is when Persephone is with Demeter. And again, this also marks kind of the winter solstice time, because winter is this time as well when Persephone would be with Hades, and I couldn't find a Saturnalia tale, so I wanted to at least give a Greek or Roman tale that pertaining to the seasons, and this one is kind of perfect because you hear it a lot, and it's not kind of one of the classic ones, so there it is. And that will also end the campfire over Saturnalia in its entirety, and we will move on to the next campfire of ancient Yule festivities. So the next festival to get into is from Scandinavian and dramatic pagan tradition of Yule or Yuletide. And like the other ones, let's get into some background first with it. And the first one I will get into is the etymology, just so there's no confusion when talking about it a little bit later. And with the other topic as being the Yuletide traditions that persist to today. Yule or Yuletide is actually a modern Old English word from the Old English Gaelor, which indicates a December festival, but also derives from the dramatic Zingsil, or the Old Norse of Yule or Ylir, and that's the first one is spelled J-O-L, and both of those meanings in dramatic and Norse still indicate a festival in December, and particularly for the Norse, this name of festivities was also contributed to the Allfather or the Longbeard Odin, who at this time of year went by Jolfr, spelled J-O-L-F-A-O-R, which is translated to Yule Father or Yulnir, the Yule One. And in Old Norse poetry, Yule or Yule was synonymous with great feast parties, and information regarding Yule also comes from a 12th century work from the Agrippa Ufre Norwegigundensen, pardon the pronunciation, and the Prose Edda, and a work by Skald Rivdareva, and from the Saga of Good King Harken. And the first to state is the Agrippa. That was a history of Norwegian kings, which started at the death of Halfdan Stravari, the Black around 860 AD and ends with Igni Kvagri ascending to the throne in 1136 AD. Though the last book of this is missing, and all the information in this is also found in a poem by Snorri Sturluson. And his poems and works cover most of Norse history and mythology. And the most notable stories of Yule is in the saga of Hárek the Good, who was king of Norway from 934 to 961 AD. And he famously fought against Eric Bloodaxe and his kin till he almost eliminated all of them who stood against him. Hárekn was also known as a king that introduced Christianity to Norway, and in his sagas, there are accounts of converting thousands to Christianity, most of them in his army. Now, before moving on from the King Hárek, I would like to read a portion of his saga talking about Yule, and I'll start now. King Hárek was a good Christian when he came to Norway, but as the whole country was heathen, with much heathenist sacrifice, and as many great people, as well as the favor of the common people, were to be consolated, so he resolved to practice his Christianity in private. But he kept Sundays and the Friday fast, and some token of the greatness of the holy days. He made a law that the festival of Yule should begin at the same time as these Christian people held it as well, and that every man under penalty should brew a meal of malt into ale, and there will keep with Yule holy as long as it lasted. Before him, the beginning of Yule, or the slaughtering night, was the night of midwinter, December 14th, and Yule was kept for 3 days thereafter. Then it continues into his Christianity, but this is all we needed, considering Yule and the December in the text are Yulier. And the festival of Yule was indicated as Yol, J-O-L, and also indicated the exact period of the winter solstice taking part. And now to go over some of the ancient rites held on Yule. All would gather to the main temple. Farmers brought livestock to be killed for the feast during the winter, and horses particularly were sacrificed and were called Hlaut, H-L-A-U-T, and blood was collected from them into vessels, and then the blood inside of these vessels was called Hlautbolli, and that just adds a B-O-L-L-I to the last word. They would then take this sacrificial esprilg leaves and twigs, and then take the blood and smear it on the pedestals of statues to their gods. Then the meat from the other animals was boiled and served at a feast. The main feast of Yule was held by the local chieftain, and he would also give thanks to the gods at this time as well. And some of these were done during the toast. One was to Odin for victory and power to the king. Another one was to Njörungr and Freya for good harvest and peace. Then a general toast for the king, and then final one for the kinsfolk who had passed. And particularly the deities that they would also honor at Yule were the Holly King and the Oak King. The Holly King ruled the dark part of the year, from midsummer to Yule, and is also called the god of the waning year. Then, around Yule, he gives his life force to the Oak King, who would rule the light part of the year from Yule to midsummer, and is referred to the god of the waxing year. And these two gods were twins, and the reason that they were giving their life force between each other during these times was in a competition to win the favor of a goddess of love. And then you have a not-so-known-about goddess, Hulda or Halia. The first one is H-U-L-D-A, and the second one is H-O-L-L-A. And this was a goddess that predated Odin, Thor, Freya, and many others in dramatic folklore, and she later became the folk character Frånhali, or Old Mother Frost, and is featured in the Grimm folktales. Then there is also a mythological belief of a certain entity or presence coming around this time of year, which is spread around multiple traditions, and if you've played the Witcher games, you know it as the Wild Hunt. And it, like I said, it's in a lot of mythologies, but in this particular trail, I will be focusing on the Scandinavian / Icelandic mythologies, since the Wild Hunt on its own could get its own trail just with the information that it has by itself. So, in Scandinavian mythology, the Wild Hunt is known as the Okoreia, O-K-O-R-E-I-A, and is a corruption of Asgardian Reo, or Odin's Hunters. In Norwegian folklore, they are called the Noise Riders, or the Ride of Asgard. The leader of the Wild Hunt was Odin the Allfather, and certain depictions of Odin, particularly with the Wild Hunt, showed him as a king who hunted on Sunday and was doomed to hunt and kill supernatural creatures till the end of time, and other accounts attribute him to being the Allfather god Odin. And again, some other accounts of the Wild Hunt itself suggest that it was led by a ghost or psychopomp of historical figures in Norwegian, Scandinavian, or Icelandic history. Then you have the participants of the Wild Hunt, which ranged from corrupted Asgardian soldiers to other Nordic deities, Valkyries, souls of the dead, and specifically when it was Odin, he had mythical dogs that he would use to chase prey, and when his dogs became tired, he sent out large birds to take their place. And in some accounts too, Odin himself would turn into a flock of ravens or a pack of dogs to chase down prey. And again, with the accounts pertaining with the Odin stories of the Wild Hunt, he is rarely seen, but when you hear the dogs barking in the distance, it either pertains to a disastrous weather coming towards the area, war and unrest, and even plague in the region. But if you were unfortunate enough to see the Wild Hunt, that meant that your death was close at hand, or you were going to be a victim of ill fortune. And worst case scenario, you could be abducted by the Wild Hunt itself as its prey. In some cases, killed or taken to the underworld Hell or Helheim. And in some accounts, you turn into a supernatural member of the Wild Hunt and are forced to hunt with Odin. And in the accounts where Odin just chases dogs, you become one of his mythical dogs. Now I will read a portion from Kodulf Hagen Gunderson's Mountain Thunder account of the Wild Hunt, at least a little portion of it. When the winter wind blows and the Yule fires are lit, it is best to stay indoors, safely shut away from the dark paths and the wild heaths. Those who wander out by themselves during the Yule night may hear a sudden rustling through the tops of the trees, a rustling that might be the wind, though the rest of the woods is still. But then the barking of dogs fills the air, and the host of the wild souls sweep down. The fires flash from the eyes of the black hounds, and hooves of the black horse or hood. And that is a pretense to the Wild Hunt coming. And that also finishes up the ancient traditions of Yule for the most part, and now we will get into some other ancient traditions, but I consider them current Yule traditions since they persist to today. So let's get into the next campfire. So like I said, this campfire will be over current Yule traditions and also their origins and some other traditions of Christmas that have came from Yule. So let me start off with decorations, and first let's go over the evergreens, which most people in Norwegian, Scandinavian, Icelandic cultures brought them in as trees and bushes and hung them in their homes by doors, windows, and from the rafters upside down, usually decorating them with food sometimes and ribbons and certain toys for children. When hung, each could represent one or multiple things, since evergreens represented and symbolized life, rebirth, renewal, everlasting life, because it was able to stay green through the death of winter. Also, the evergreen tree itself is a Yule tree symbol, which was a tradition of putting a tree in the town center or a town focal point area, and represented the world tree in Norse mythology, and was decorated with pine cones, berries, and other fruits which were sacred to the gods and goddesses in Norse mythology. And one of the things that was used to decorate these evergreens is mistletoe, which was also talked about with the Romans. And for the Norse, this plant was hung over doorways as a way to protect against evil, and was also worn as an amulet or hung above beds as a symbol of fertility. And then they also had a similar tradition to kissing under the mistletoe, which was a ritual connected to the goddess Freya, the goddess of love, beauty, and fertility. Then, of course, there is the famous connection to the Norse mythology god Balder, who was the most loved of the Norse gods, and son of Freya or Frigga. And the story goes that she loved him so much that she wanted to keep him from harm. So she went around and made everything in creation promise not to hurt Balder, but overlooked mistletoe, thinking it was no threat. But Loki wanted to kill Balder for some reason and found this out, and through trickery convinced Hodur to shoot Balder in a game which they played often as children. And Loki ended up putting mistletoe on the end of an arrow, and Hodur shot it and killed Balder. Frigga was filled with grief and went and cried over him, and her tears became the white berries of the mistletoe plant. And then she went off to try to find a way to revive Balder. And the only way she could do this is if every living creature cried for Balder. And she set out to try to accomplish this. And after some headaches and shape-shifting bullshit from Loki, Frigga was able to bring Balder back to life. And that is a simple story, which is a connection between Freya or Frigga to mistletoe and Norse traditions connected to the mistletoe plant. And then also, here is a small riddle. I lived my life between the worlds. Neither earth nor sky would call me child. The birds were my companions, the wind and rain my mentor. Daily I grew in power and strength, till snatched out of time by the trickster. What is this? The answer, mistletoe. Now for the next decoration, holly, which was also often placed around doorways, windows, fireplaces. This was because the spiky bristles were believed to repel evil and also symbolize goodwill, potent life energy, and the red berries on it represented the female fertility aspects of life. Then you have ivy, which was often paired with holly specifically to add to the symbolized female fertility, like mentioned with the red berries earlier, and is similar to some of the traditions that were found in Saturnalia. Then, with the use of these elements, one of the two other traditions were also practiced, and the first one I will talk about is the kiss broth. And this was a oval-shaped wreath made from two branches of evergreen leaves or branches, and at the top was bound by holly and ivy, and at the bottom was bound with mistletoe, and apples were placed in the evergreen around it, and fruits were hung to be positioned in the center along with dolls. And for every berry of mistletoe on this was a promise of a kiss. And when one is given, one of the berries is removed, and when all the berries were taken off, this was taken down. And most of the time, one was typically found in each house during Yule. And then that kind of brings me to the second practice, which is just a plain wreath, which took evergreen branches and twisted them into a circle shape as we see it today, and used holly and ivy to bind it into shape. and often decorated with pine cones, berries, and other fruits and vegetables to represent the gods, and sometimes had children's dolls and toys put on it. And in a whole, this whole wreath was used to represent a completion of a year or the cycle of a year. The pine cones, berries, ivy, and fruit and other things represented peace, goodwill, joyfulness, and the Norse deities that they worship. Now, before moving on from the trees and plants, there is another tradition, which is the Yule log. And this entails taking a huge log from a fallen ash tree and burn to honor Thor. And it is believed that if a burnt Yule log was present in a person's home, it protected them from Thor's lightning. Another tradition with the Yule log was a celebration that would be taking the Yule log and burning it and partying until it was completely ash. And the reason that it was a ash tree as well was the world tree in Norse mythology was a ash tree, and this was another representation of the Norse mythologies and the world tree aspect of that mythology. And there is some other aspects of the Yule log, but it mainly pertains to food, and I will touch on that a little bit after we finish up with some of the other decorations and other things that were used to celebrate during this time. So the first thing to get into next would be the candles. These were used to symbolize the eternal fire, light, and warmth of the sun. They were used to symbolize the chasing away of evil and to keep hope for the sun's return. The second is bells, and they were rung every morning as people woke up to chase away the darkness and welcome the warmth of the sun. Then third is colors that were associated with Yule, which were red, green, white, silver, and gold. Red was to represent fertility and for the Holly King or the waning god. Green was to represent peace, goodwill, and the Oak King or the waxing year god. White represented purity and hope of a new light or rebirth. Silver represented the moon and the cycles of the moon. Then gold represented the sun and the solar god being reborn. And also these lights had other attachments to Norse deities as well. Then fourth and last are just a little bit of tidbits with some stones that were also associated with Yule. And that was rubies and bloodstones were similar for the reasons of the color red. And then emeralds, again, like the color green, was another representation of those elements. Then garnets and diamonds were there to represent the silver and gold representations that the colors presented too. And now to get into another larger aspect of the Yule traditions, and that was the food involved. So the first food to look at real quick is gingerbread. This was a late addition to the Yule celebrations coming in the 11th century. But this was a particularly liked bread, and it wasn't widely available, meant that it was only brought out during celebrations, and hence was tied to the Yule celebration in the fall. Then the second thing is the Yule ham, which later became the Christmas ham tradition, but the Yule version had a little bit more context to the older festivals that Bruce pronounced, and that is a wild boar was caught and sacrificed to the Norse god Freya during the feast at Yule and is a centerpiece at Christmas dinners today. And there's a particular story of something similar to this in the halls of Valhalla, where the fallen soldiers that were Odin's warriors, when they got done fighting for the day, would chase a single boar for the day, kill it, and that boar would come back each day, and that one single boar would fill all the men in Odin's halls. Then the third food, which is more of a tradition, and it's similar to the milk and cookies thing that kids do for Santa nowadays, and that was when Norse children that were waiting for gifts from the Allfather Odin would set out carrots or hay for Odin's horse, Sleipnir, when Odin was out for his wild hunt. Then the fourth food is the Yule log cake, or Brusten de Nul, which is spelled B-U-C-H-E space D-E space N-O-E-L, which is a symbolic depiction of the Yule log, which I mentioned earlier. And today, it's mainly a rolled ganache sponge cake filled with cream and covered with icing and frosting. And before I move on from Yule food, here is a recipe for a Yule buttermilk bread charm recipe. And first I will go over the ingredients, then the preparation on how to cook it. You take 3 mugs of strong white flour, 500 milligrams of buttermilk, 1 teaspoonful of bicarbonated soda, 4 dessert spoons of honey, 3 dessert spoons of golden syrup, 4 dessert spoons of mixed peels, 3/4 cup of mixed dried fruit, 3 pieces of ginger roughly chopped, chopped walnuts, and rich brown sugar. Now for how to make it. Place the flour in a large bowl and mix it well with the baking soda and the buttermilk, and also add in the salt and honey. Then while mixing it, do it until the dough feels a little bit spongy. Then mix some of the ginger with the syrup to add a little bit of flavor to it. And you can either leave the ginger in or take it out, depending if you want that extra zing that the ginger would provide. Then when done mixing, grab a board, dust it with flour, and add in the dry fruit to the dough, and then flatten it out onto the board, making it into the shape of a oval, and then score the bread 8 times on its back, brush it with milk, and sprinkle on some of the nuts and brown sugar. And you could also grease the baking tray, depending on what you want. Put in the oven for 20 to 25 minutes on around 400 degrees, and just make sure to monitor it and check when it starts to get golden brown, and make sure to cut into it to make sure the whole loaf cooks through. And that is the first recipe. The second recipe I wanted to go over is for a Yule log cake, and is a basic Yule log cake. And like the other one, I will go over the ingredients first and then go over into how it's made. So, ingredients. 6 egg whites, room temperature, 3/4 cup of sugar, 6 egg yolks, 1/3 cup unsweetened cocoa, 1/2 teaspoon of vanilla extract, 1 dash of salt, and some confectioner's sugar. Now to the baking portion. Grease the bottom of a 15 by 10 by 1 inch jelly roll pan. Line it with wax paper. Lightly grease that as well. Preheat the oven to 375. Then grab a large mixing bowl and mix the egg whites till they are soft and smooth. Then add 1/4 cup of sugar, 2 tablespoons at a time, and mix while adding the sugar. All this is done at a fast speed or on a high speed setting if using an electric mixer. Then do the same thing with the yolks, but they should end up very thick after 4 minutes. And again, this is done on fast or on the high speed setting. Then add the egg yolks to the cocoa, salt, and vanilla. Then put the mixer on low speed or mix it slowly until smooth. Then with a wire whisk or rubber spatula, fold the cocoa and yolk mixture with the egg whites till no egg white shows. Then spread on a pan, bake for 15 minutes or until the surface it slightly springs back when gently pressed. Then peel off pan, add confectioner sugar, roll up and let cool, then decorate with frosting if you want to. And that is how you would make a Yule log cake. Now for the last Yule food, which is actually a drink. And this recipe and food item also kind of ties into the last tradition, because they are both the name the same thing, which is pronounced wassail and spelled W-A-S-S-A-I-L. And typically this is what you would need to make this drink. 3 to 4 pints of ale or beer, 1/2 cup of sugar, 1/4 cup mixed spice, cinnamon sticks work, whole cloves work, 2 to 3 small sweet apples cut up, one and one-fourth cup of pineapple juice, 1 1-fourth cup of orange juice, 2 lemons worth of juice. And then how you make it is you heat up the ale, and right before it boils, add some milk cream to it, and it should float on the top like foam, and then add in the other ingredients to the ale, and then add this into a large bowl, mix it slightly, and that is all you gotta do for it. And I also was able to find a non-alcoholic version, which is 8 cups of apple juice or cider, 2 cups of cranberry juice, 3/4 cup of sugar, 1 tablespoon of allspice, 2 cinnamon sticks, 1 orange, and 25 to 30 whole cloves. And what you do to make the non-alcoholic version is turn on a crock pot, set it on high, pour in the apple and cranberry juice, then stir in the sugar, allspice, and then put in the cinnamon sticks. Then stud a orange with the 25 to 30 whole cloves. Put that into the pot. Then cover and let cook on high for about an hour. Then put on low and let simmer for about 3 more hours. And this is all you would need to do it. And the tradition of using this drink also comes from the Scandinavian tradition of Yule booking, which is J-U-L-E-B-U-K-K-I-N-G, or Vashali, V-E-S-H-E-I-L-L, which is where the English got the tradition of using whistling as a basically caroling, where they went around and sang to people door to door and were given gifts, or they gave gifts as treats. And typically they would use this drink that I just described being carried in a large bowl, and whenever they would sing to a house, they would give it to the people that they were singing to, or just share it about to people that they met on the streets. And is also why the caroling and the drink share the same name, since they were both used at the same time. And specifically for the Norse tradition, people would dress up in costumes, and some accounts gave that when they visited a house, the guests that they visited had a game where they would guess who was under the costume if they knew who it was. And in some other traditions, when the singers came to a house and they finished a song, they would be given certain treats like desserts, cookies, or that type when they left. And in some accounts too, when a caroling group would show up to a house, at least one member to the house that they showed up to would join the group and sing along with them until the night was finished. And then coming to the last tradition that Yule had along with it was something called the Yule Goat. And it also was tied to the Norse tradition of caroling as well, because dolls made of straw with red ribbons in the shape of a goat were given out by the singers later in time. And it became its own symbol entirely of Yule. And some also tie it back to a Proto-Slavic Kolindai, K-O-L-I-A-D-A festival, honoring the god Dizak, or Dugsbog, and he was represented by a white goat, and possibly migrated over to Norse mythology. And in Norse mythology, it was easy to tie with it, since the god Thor had a chariot which was drawn by 2 goats, called Tangenlir and Tangengloster. Though this tradition of the Yule Goat doesn't have much information on it, you can still see the practice of making huge goat effigies made of straw and wood in certain festivals along Scandinavian and Icelandic villages and tribes today. And that basically finishes up the last campfire, and then I'll go into my thoughts real quick, which isn't really a campfire, it's more of just why I decided to do this type of episode and what I like about this type of thing, and it's going to be real quick. I like these type of episodes because it gives a little depth into certain aspects of celebrations that we had, kind of like I did on the Halloween episode. It kind of gives context on why we celebrate the way we do, and why certain tropes or aspects of the celebration kind of persist over time and are absorbed by more cultures. And particularly with Christmas and stuff, I just don't like the Christian mythologies because it just doesn't have that much backing. Like some of the Norse stories for why they had these celebrations and other things gives more background, gives more interesting stories, gives more interesting storytelling around this time of year, which is what you need, a reasoning behind the year, a reasoning behind why it's so cold, so dark, and all that stuff, which a lot of Paleolithic, Neolithic, and ancient peoples all feared, especially because they were mainly farming cultures, and since we're out of that type of era, it seems kind of not important, but it's still a good storytelling because we still use ghost stories to be told around Christmas and that kind of stuff. So it's nice just to lump in mythology with some of those ghost stories too. And for some people, they might not know some of the backstory behind why red, green, and that kind of stuff is such a persistent color in Christian Christmas celebrations or American Christmas celebrations. It's just kind of there. And some younger people that don't even go into history that much might not even realize why certain symbology is represented in certain costumes, certain outfits, certain gift-giving things, and certain traditions around this time of year. So I just like to talk about some of them, and again, this is a more of a part one, I guess, because we could talk about Yule in a later episode or a future Christmas episode in more detail or certain aspects specifically, because one Christmas I might just go into Christmas trees specifically and go through a whole history of those, since there's so much just about that one topic specifically. But I just wanted to go over a roundabout on why the solstice is so important to ancient cultures, why it was celebrated, why it became a festive time, and then why that kind of transferred over now. Because especially with the Roman aspect of Saturnalia and Brumalia, a lot of those could be easily taken over by the Christian church, since the Roman Empire is the one that came up with the Christian mythology and the Christian worships and the Christian holidays and all that. They probably used a lot of these older rituals as a basis for what they interpreted to do, or used certain symbols that were popular with common people to kind of get them over to their religion at the time, and then it just kind of stuck and then morphed into its own thing now, which is just a modern Christmas, which you see the lights, the Christmas tree, and all that stuff, but not a lot of people know why we even have the Christmas tree in the first place and why we decorate it with what we do. And also, I wanted to bring in some recipes too with it, just to see if anybody wanted to try make any of this stuff for the Yuletide Festival, because I end up making a couple things from the recipes I found just when I researched some of the topics and stuff. So if you're interested in it, research some Yuletide recipes and you might like some of the stuff you find. And some of the foods that you might find are some of the foods that I might talk about next week when we go into some holidays around the world. Because that'll be more of a shorter episode, because it'll be coming out right on Christmas, and I'll basically just go through a short what people celebrate around the world in different countries, and maybe tell some ghost stories, some other stories, or maybe some mythology stories, depending on what I have and what time I have. And then after that, in case I don't mention in the other episode or the end or the outro, there will be a, I'm pretty sure it's probably going to be about a 3-week break right after the Christmas episode as a holiday break for me. I might still record some stuff just to have it in the bank, and then it'll start coming out 3 weeks after on Friday after Christmas. So, and with that, let's get into the mythological minute for this episode and finish it out. Now for the mythological minute. And we're going to stay in the Icelandic, Norse, and Germanic mythology with a troll clan of Graham, and sometimes is a giantess clan, but in both times it is around a central figure of Graham. And they lived in what was described as a lava fortress of Dinningenburg, or Dinningengug, in the Mesitane area of northern Iceland. She is said to have hooves and have small horns on her head, with a very large and warty nose. She used to also possess multiple heads, but is now commonly depicted with only one. She also possessed 13 to 15 tails, and on each she had about 100 sacks, all meant for children, which she abducted. The reason she abducted children was because she had an irresistible taste and appetite for the flesh of naughty children. And during this time of year, she had no short supply, since she collected whispers about naughty children throughout the year, and during December she descended and set out to collect naughty children to cook up in a winter stew. And she also had a few mythological companions. The first one was something called the Gula Knuni, the Yule Cat, an enormous black cat who had an appetite for children, but didn't seek out just naughty children. This cat sought out and preyed on children who didn't get new clothes for Christmas. Then, the second companion she had was her husband, which she had multiple before him, but whenever she tired of one of her husbands, she just killed them. And her current husband is Leopoldi, who is described as disabled and lazy, being limp in his legs. With these husbands of hers, she had about 13 kids, which are referred to as the Yule Lads, or Julgen Snuva, who pulled pranks and scared people from December 12th to December 25th. And I won't read their original names since I've already tried a couple pronunciations throughout this trail already. And well, they're pretty difficult in themselves since I can't really speak English already good. So we'll just stick with the Englandizationed names that they have. And some of them might seem out of place and they're really on the nose. So if you are interested in them, just look them up later as the Yule Lads. And in some accounts, they specifically showed up on a day of December and stayed there until the 25th. And in some accounts, they would show up on that specific day and then leave. So, the first Yule Lad is Sheep Cutcod. He arrives on December 12th and is said to be deformed from the knees down, having wood pegs and not being able to bend from the knees. He would come and harass and scare sheep. And since the sheep were stored underground, you could hear the cries of the sheep throughout the house when he came. Then the second Yule Lad is Gully Gwark. He came on December 13th. He waited for people to sleep, and then he would steal their milk by drinking it straight from the cow's udders or stealing it from any that has been stored in the house. And since cream is used in multiple Yule recipes, it was an important ingredient during this time of year. Then the third Yule Lad, Stubby. He came on December 14th. And he was the shortest of the Yule Lads. He came and stole the house pans, which were still covered with crumbs from Yule dishes. Then the fourth Yule Lad is Spoon Licker, and he showed up on the 15th of December. He was also considered to be deformed because of how skinny he was, where you could almost see his bones. And like his name, he would come and steal spoons, still that had food on them, and lick them clean. Next is Potlicker, or Pot Scraper Yule Lad, who came on December 16th, and much like his brother, he seeked out pots with food and meat left in them, and would eat any leftovers that he could find. Then the creepy brother, Bowl Licker, of the Yule Lads, showed up on December 17th. He would stay under kids' beds and wait for them to finish their nighttime soups or nighttime pudding. And when the bowls were placed on the floor, the Yule Lad would eat anything left in the bowl. Then Door Slammer Yule Lad showed up on December 18th. He would simply run through the town and slam people's doors that weren't secured shut. Then you have Skitter Gobbler, and he came on December 18th, and he only stole Skryr, which is S-K-Y-R, which was a type of cream found in a lot of Yule dishes, and he only stole the specific type of dish. Then you have the Sausage Snatcher, and he came on the 20th of December, and he would hide in the rafters waiting for a specific Icelandic smoked sausage to be made, which was called Bjugu, B-J-U-G-U, and then when it was made and stored away, he would steal it. Then you had the Window Peeper, and was said to be the biggest of the Yule Lads. He showed up on December 21st, and he only wandered around and scared children that were staring out into the darkness of the night. Then you had Door Sniffer of the Yule Lads. He came on December 22nd, and he had the biggest nose of the Yule Lads, which he used to locate his favorite meal, which was called leaf bread. And once found, he would snatch up any he could grab. Then you had Meat Hook Yule Lad, and he would be around on the 23rd of December. and he was known to hide somewhere in the kitchen or close by and wait till the family would be asleep and steal any meat laying out with his massive meat hook, which gave him his name. Then the last Yule Lad, the Candle Stealer, who showed up on the 24th of December, and he stole candles, most of the time lit ones. And he stole them not for the flame, but he stole them so he could eat the tallows that the candles were made from. Then, on December 25th, Grella would descend to gather up any naughty children for her feast, and return to her home until next Yule. And that is the end of the mythological minute for this trail. And that finishes up this trail this week. Also, there will be no poll. I will still be out for any ghost stories, mythology stories, or any folklore stories of your area. Or if you want to send in how you celebrate Christmas or this time of year, then I'll might tell your recounting and at least give your name out or whatever you want to use your username or whatever as. And all the credits for the music, anywhere I found information, and where you can find this podcast and the Facebook page will be down below. If you feel like donating, go to the Anchor page. You can feel free to donate there. Go to the Facebook page if you want to grab the link for the Anchor page, and then go subscribe to any other podcatcher that you might like. And any messages you want to send in to the podcast, please send them to the Facebook page as well. And this has been the Great Journey Podcast with your trail guide, Luke Keesh. I will stay here stoking the fire until you guys decide to return. Until next time, I hope you enjoyed.
Thunder and lightning struck by your tower today. And though the world wasn't frightened, you sent the whole world away. And now you heard them there alone in your tower of tears. Every step and every stone filled with millions of fears. You pulled blood and brittle bones clutter and crack beneath your halo. Cut down by the crew on the crash pool. Catch out from the mighty and high. Ain't no one left for the good to go. No truth in a world full of lies. Wash your hands of all the blood, beg, borrowed and stole to keep a good man down. Shake the hands of Holy Ghost, dance along an ivory coast. Share your flesh with passing shadows on a bed of broken hopes. Be sure to breathe in deeply every medicine that your lungs can hold. Welcome all your bastard actions back home. Soul saving saints, to the blood in the same God's holy name. We were the heathens to their saints, spilling blood in the same God's holy name. Shake the hands of Holy Ghost, dance along an ivory coast. Share your flesh with passing shadows on a bed of broken hopes. Be sure to breathe in deeply every bit of sin that your lungs can hold. Welcome all your bastard actions back home.